Okay, it's October 30th, 2009. Joan Weaver and Rosetta Graff are in the home of Jeff Mead in Lewis, Kansas. And Jeff, can you tell us your full name?
My full name is Jeffress Michael Mead.
And where do you currently reside?
1715 U Road.
And where and when were you born?
July 5th, 1930.
And where?
In the Spearville Hospital.
And what were the names of your parents?
My mom was June, later Newsom. She was a registered nurse.
And your grandparents?
My grandparents is Lawrence W. and Eva Jeffries.
And you know the other side? Grandparents or not?
I believe it was Otto and Anna Mead. Grandparents.
What brought your people to this area of Kansas? You know, your grandparents or whoever came here first?
My great granddad. They lived in Dark County, Ohio, and I don't know why he came here, but he came out here in 1903 and bought this quarter of ground that we live on, Southwest 1/4 of 1426 18, in 1903, and this house that we're in right now. I understand was built in the fall of 1903 and the spring of 1904.
And he came here to farm?
Yes.
So he'd been a farmer in Ohio too?
Yeah. Yes, the family did. They came here and then he went back. He came out here and bought the quarter and then he went back and got the family, put them on the train, and I don't know why, but they got off the train in Belpre, and he bought a team and a wagon. And my granddad, I think, was 11 years old, and he told me, of course, this country was all grass at that time. And when they came across the creek right north of Centerview, Grandpa said it was the water was running fast enough that it floated the wagon. But the team was a big, strong team, and they got across okay.
Let's see. Coming in here. Hi there. Describe the household that you grew up in. What was the family, brothers, or step, whatever?
Okay. My grandparents, Lawrence and Eva Jeffries, came to Spearville Hospital. My mom and dad were split before I was born. Okay, they came. I was born in Spearville Hospital. Folks came and got us. I was born on the 5th, and then the 20th they came and got us and brought us to this house. And my mother was here until I was a year and a half old, so I'm told. And then she went to Springfield, Missouri, to Burge Hospital to take nurse's training and become an RN, which she did. But my grandparents, Lawrence and Eva Jeffries, did not adopt me. They just raised me. And I'm so thankful.
And so were you the only child then in the household?
Well, they had a younger daughter, a daughter younger than my mother, was here until 1938, and then she went to college. She graduated from Centerview in 36. And of course, folks didn't have the money to send her to college. And finally, somehow, they got it lined up to where she worked there in Hutchinson, and she graduated from Hutchinson JUCO, and then went on and graduated from Manhattan K-State. So she helped me raise me somewhat, you know.
Yeah, she would have been older. So what was life like growing up in this house when you were a child?
I have nothing but good memories. Of course, I didn't know at the time, but there was so much love in his home. My grandmother was not able to carry a baby full term. And the two females, you know, females have more will to live. And they both made it. But the three little boys didn't make it. I mean, would have been boys.
Okay, you were born in 1930, so do you have any memories of the Dust Bowl?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Do I?
Let's talk about that a little.
Okay. 3-4 years ago in the Hutchinson paper, there was a big article about Palm Sunday of 1935. That particular day, my Aunt Joanne hadn't graduated from Centerview yet, so she was in a quartet, and this is Palm Sunday, and so the quartet was to meet at the Methodist Church in Centerview that afternoon and practice Easter music. And so I went with Grandpa and had an old rickety building out there and where he kept the car, and we got the car out, and as we came around to park in front of the house here, so my aunt could take the car and go practice music. And there, I wish I knew how tall those clouds were. That rolling dust, it was coming toward us. And Grandpa told me, he said, you get in the house and I'll put the car away. Which he did, and it hit before he got back to house. And in this house, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, of course, there wasn't any insulation in the house. You know, when they built them in those days, it was a wall, and it was all lath and plaster. That was the only insulation. But in this house, right here where we are sitting, I would not have been able to see your face. You people would just been a shadow in the dirt.
And we're only about 3 feet away.
Yes. And even if you got right against him, you're still not going to see the face. Right. It was dark enough, of course everybody had chicken those days, that the chickens went to roost. And I'm not quite 5 years old, but the folks are down in the dumps. I heard them say, well, another crop gone, you know where. And the wind is just blowing terrible. I suppose 60, 70 mile an hour, I don't know. But I do remember that the folks had told me, we had a wooden windmill, Derek. But the folks told me, even though that's wooden, do not touch that windmill, Derek, in a storm. The stack electricity is just snapping off everything because it's dry and it's dirty. And like I say, I wasn't quite 5 years old, but it comes to me, is this the end of the world? It looked it. Then, after that, along about 39, when things kind of turned around a little, Grandpa and I are in Centerview. I think we're in the Tom Stage garage. And I can't remember what neighbor that he's talking to, because Grandpa's dad had given him this half section and the quarter north of it, and that quarter west of Dodge City. And I heard Grandpa and this neighbor talking, and Grandpa told me, the guy said, wanted to know about, you know, how much ground that his dad had given him, and he said, I would have walked away and left it. Where would we have gone? It was pretty, pretty bad in the 30s.
Do you remember, you were living on a farm and stuff, did you still have plenty to eat, because, or not, or was it still hard to grow things?
No. We had a big garden. I don't know if it was 3/4 of an acre. I have no idea. I just know there was a lot of garden. Of course, Grandma had me out there in the summertime, you know, hoeing, and the windmill run most of the time and water it, you know. And I think as long about 1936, that the government decided the only way they would stop the sweeping wind was to plant trees. And my granddad, Lawrence W. Jeffries, was a big worker in Farm Bureau. And him and Willie Warwick and Leo Kraft, of course, nobody had a pickup in those days. You're lucky to have a car. They were all Farm Bureau workers. They took the back seat out of the cars. The tree seedlings came in to Fort Hays. They took the back seat out of the car, and they went to Hays and got those seedlings and brought them back. And that day, what later was ASC office, and now it's FSA office, was in the basement of the courthouse, as I recall. And they brought those seedlings there, and people picked up the seedlings there. Okay. From this house west to the road, my grandparents planted those trees, and I'm sure I was a lot of help. I was there, I suppose. Anyway, the jackrabbits were numerous. I mean big jackrabbits. And so every tree we planted, we had to cover it with chicken wire, or the rabbits would eat it right into the ground.
And that was what year did you say?
Well, that was along about 1936, 37, as I recall.
And those trees are still the ones we're seeing
now. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Now later, when WPA started planting trees, they planted trees that go south and then a half mile east. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the WPA, that gave men jobs. They kept them, they called it hoeing. They kept them hoed. And you pull their, it was called a hoe. It was just kind of like a grater blade. But anyway, you either pulled that with a team of horses or your tractor. And we had a tractor. Grandpa pulled it with that.
So
when the trees were little.
Yeah. But your grandfather wasn't part of the WPA.
No.
He would help keep the trees up after they had been planted, or the WPA kept them
well,
up?
The windmill was never shut off, and he had a 200-gallon tank in the back of this old Model T Ford truck. And I don't remember how much water we gave each one of those trees. Now, we didn't water the WPA trees. We watered these trees. And every day or two, that was just one of the things we did.
And the trees are cedar and Russian olive. What are the locusts?
Yeah, there's Kentucky locust and cedar. Oh dear, and elm. There's some elm trees, and I'm not
so
sure.
So it was a mixture.
Oh yes, yeah. Everybody took a mixture, because they at that time I don't think they were sure what trees would survive. I believe that was the reason you had a mixture.
Anything else about that time period?
Well,
you were in school, elementary school at this.
At Centerview.
Centerview.
But see, at the age I was, I didn't know we was poor. How would I know? Because that big garden, we never went hungry. Grandma canned all summer. And that's what we ate during the winter.
And did you have cattle too, and
yes,
dogs?
We
and
had.
Chickens?
We always had three milk cows, and we had chickens. And I don't recall what year. Late 30s, early 40s. Anyway, ahead of the Second World War. I'm going to guess it's about 1938. This 3-acre lot, in the middle of that big shed, goes to almost to Lynn's house. There's 3 acres there. And Grandpa never had sows, but we full fed pigs, hogs. And you had self feeder, and we kept water. And we had, in those days, there was a livestock sale pavilion in Greensburg on Friday, one in Kinsley on Saturday, and Larned was on Thursday. Well, when they had some fat hogs, we'd take fat hogs. At that time, we raised them to 350 pounds, approximately. Take them to the sale, and he always bought some weaning pigs and brought back. So we had them all sizes, you know, and it was a continuous thing.
So what were your chores during this time period?
Well,
besides weeding the garden.
Of course, that wasn't every day. And but when I got home from school, it was my job to gather the eggs and make sure the chickens had water and whatever the hogs needed, you know. But we, Grandpa went to the Lewis Co-op. They had a grinder, you know, and grind Milo and wheat for hog feed and put supplement in it.
Who did the milking?
Well, it was my job to help. I was never sent down there unless Grandpa was sick. I was never sent down there until I got older to milk by myself. But the one thing, maybe you can tell me, I never could quite understand. This is some trees now, but that was the pasture. That's where the cattle roamed. When I got old enough to drive and maybe date, if I was crowded for time, the cows were always standing clear against that east fence with their back to the barn, and you could holler, you could honk the horn on the car, do whatever you wanted to. They'd never look at you. But on the evening when he had all evening, they were standing at the barn door trying to knock it open to get him to get the feed. Nobody's ever been able to tell me why it's that way, but that's the way it is.
Just a woman thing.
Well, I never thought about that. Probably right.
Okay, so do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Absolutely.
Can you tell us what you were doing that day?
Well, to back up just a little bit, okay. Devon Stade grew up in Centerview. It was his dad that run the garage in Centerview. So had gas pumps and sold gas and did all the mechanical work for this area and welding and just kept things going. Anyway, Devon and I grew up together. My grandmother was one of eight children, and I can remember her telling me one time, I suppose I was around 10 years old, she said, I don't want you playing with any boys that's more than a year older than you are, because they'll tell you things you don't need to know. So Devon was the one I played with.
We weren't plugged in here. We better hope this worked.
So
why not more than a year older than you?
Because they'll tell you things I don't need to know.
Oh.
But you got to remember, she was born in 1890, and she was one of 11 children. And that is her house. You abide by those rules, or you can pack your suitcase and leave. And that didn't really appeal to me, because there was something to eat here and people to take care of me. And they were very good to me. Probably too good. But I love the memory of those people. Mm-hmm. You bet.
So you were leading up to what, December 7th?
Oh, yes. if, because I hate to tell you this, I was never a good reader. I read what I had to, you know, but it wasn't the majority. I'd rather, when I got home from school, sat in a, Grandpa had an Atwater Kent radio. Of course, this is for electricity, and it ran on a 6-volt battery. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you get right in the middle of a program, you know, and it just start fading away. And we had no way to charge the battery. But
so you had no electricity in this house? No,
not until after I graduated from high school. We had Coleman light, which was a good bright light. But now, where were we? I can't.
December 7th.
Oh, yes, December 7th. Devon Stade had an uncle that he thought the world. It was a brother to Tom Stade, his dad, who had joined the Navy in 1938 to make a career of it. So when this hit, especially when the Korean thing hit, we had, because we were together a lot, we had talked about it. Well, if you and me, if we have to go to service, what service? And this is not knocking any branch of service. I'm just telling you what our desires were. Well, it wasn't any question of Devon, because he said, Uncle Orton was in the Navy. That's what I want to join. And I wanted to join the Air Force. I thought that would just be all right. Anyway, on December 7th, now, like I kind of got off the story there. I do not know if I had ever heard of Pearl Harbor. I'm not sure until then. I might have, but if I did, it was because of Devon's uncle. Might have, you know, the ship might have went through there or something. But it scared me so, because I didn't really understand about war. I guess that's, because I wasn't used to what happens in a war. And I thought that would, in my mind, this is my mind, I wondered, will they come marching down our road? What the heck did I know that they wouldn't? And I knew if they did, you know, we're in big trouble. So it just swelled up my chest. I could hardly breathe. So that's what I remember the most.
Did you hear it on the radio, or were you told?
No, I think Grandpa heard it on the radio. As I recall, Grandma had me out there where those bushes are. And in those days, you know, our deep freeze was go get a hen or two and kill them and fix them, you know, pull the heads off. And that's what we, that was a deep freeze. If the company drove in unexpected, which they didn't very often, but if they did, we just kill more chickens, and that's what we ate. But as I recall, the way I remember, of course, this was for electricity, so he was shaving, Grandpa was shaving with a straight edge. And he come busting out the door, it was over here then, and run towards Grandma, and he said, "My God, Eva, I just heard that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor." Well, that really got my... I didn't understand about war, you know. Later it came to me, if they come down marching down our road, we're in trouble. So I think that's the way I heard about it. And like I say, I don't know if I'd ever heard of Pearl Harbor before that or not. But it did instill in me, after the war was over and we had won, that I have got to see Pearl Harbor. Just one of those things I've got to do before I leave this country. And I've been fortunate enough, we've been there twice. And so the USS Arizona Memorial, and just blows me away. We were there in, 96, I believe it was the last time. And there's still diesel fuel coming up out of that ship. It just doesn't hardly seem possible to me.
After Pearl Harbor, did you have other, I don't know whether it was your cousins, uncles, or whatever, that were drafted, that did go into service?
Well, my Aunt Joanne, who was here until 38, and went on to Hudson Juco and then K-State, there was a young man that grew up in southern Nebraska, the name of Martin V. West, who grew up in a big family. Of course, nobody, you know, didn't have much money. So in December of 1940, he joined the National Guard. Now that's 1940. And because he loved horses. So he joined the cavalry part of the. And he was stationed at Fort Riley. And that is how my uncle by marriage, Martin V. West, and my Aunt Joanne got acquainted and married. And I wish I could remember. Now, he was, at first, he was in the cavalry. Then they did away with the cavalry, and he was in amphibious tanks. He hauled troops and supplies in, and he was in the Pacific. And I cannot even remember all the names of the islands that he went in on, but he was in on a bunch of them. I can remember Lady and Truck. That's two that I can think of that he was in on. And he never got hurt. And in fact, this fall, in August, we celebrated his 90th birthday. Now, my aunt's gone, been gone since 96, but he's still going. And we had a big celebration, and I have thanked him many times for what he did for the United States of America.
What did you notice during the war? What were the changes in the county?
Well, yes, a few. Now, I wrote this down, and I don't know what else was rationed. Of course, there was no vehicle, new vehicle sitting around to buy. No tractors, and all that bit. As far as I know, the only thing I could think of was white sugar was ration, tires were ration, and the only reason I know this is because my Uncle Bill Nichols from the pool hall in Dodge City, or in Kinsley, beer was ration. And I don't have any idea, you know, what the quota was. His beer came from Dodge City. But I don't know that. And all tires in those days, there wasn't such a thing yet as tubeless tires. Every tire had a tube in it. In the car, in our car, you had what I call a bicycle pump. So you could pump it. And you had patching and glue. That was all in a kit in the car. And when you had a flat tire, you jacked it up, and you took the wheel off the car, and you laid it down, and you had tire tools. And you got the tire off the rim on one side where you could get the tube pulled out. You patched the tube, you put it back, put the tire back together, and you pumped it up by hand. That was how things were done in those days. Also, as far as gas rationing, you had a sticker. Every car had to have a sticker. Oh, let's back up a little bit. It was 35 mile an hour. You did not drive over 30 miles, as far as I know, ever. Because if you did, and they caught you, they took your gas tickets. So when your tank ran empty, there sat the car. So everybody was dedicated to win the war, as far as I know. I never heard anybody say anything to not want to win the war. There may have been some, you know, but I don't know. Now then, in the windshield of the car, you had an A. That was the smallest amount of gas. But if you had a B, that was more gas. And then there was also a C, and that's what we had because we were full feeding hogs. Okay, like I told you, we raised fat hogs up to 350 pounds. And I wish I knew when this happened. They put out the word, we've got to have them to 500 pounds because that extra fat, as I understand it, made explosives. So we didn't have the very best of loading equipment. We had this two-wheel trailer. I still have it out here. Grandpa had made when we started full feeding hogs. A blacksmith made it in Greensburg. And we would back up, mark the ground, and pull ahead, hook the car. We had no pickup. We had trailer hitch put on the car. And then we would dig those holes down for the trailer tires to drop down in so that the trailer was sitting right on the ground. And that way you could encourage the hogs to. And when you're loading fat hogs, you do not get them excited. If you do, you can lose 50 pounds of weight. Well, you just kind of nudge them along, you know. You may want to say something, but you don't say it. Encourage them to get in the trailer. And then when they get in there, you get the end gate in. And if it's hot weather, we'd drive around here by the windmill, and we would water them down, keep them cool. So if they get hot and upset, they lose all that weight. And then we would head for the sale. And the men that worked at these sale pavilions, anytime I was there, they knew what was expected. They didn't try to get them all upset and everything.
What did you do during that time? For entertainment, or what was going on in that time?
Well, of course, at Centerview, we had basketball and baseball. And a boy growing up, you know, you wanted to be part of it. That was a big deal. And Bernard Martin was the principal and the coach for a long time at Centerview. And
how far did you go for games and things? Sticking with the gas.
The one time I really remember, Cindy went to Radium, I believe it was, which is quite a ways away. Mm-hmm. It's off up northeast. This was after I was in high school. And this is something that you wouldn't even contemplate doing today. We had a school bus. We were in a school bus. We left Radium, and the game's over. And we got about a mile, and the headlights went out. And we had clinch lights, and it was a moonlight night. And this bus, instead of having fuses, had something new. It had breakers. Well, if you had a short, you know, the breaker would open up, and the lights would go out. And then after it cooled down, it'd go back on. And we drove from Radium to Centerview. There's kids on the bus that way. But we had clinch lights. So that was one time we played Centerview played we played Zook and Truesdale and Fellsburg and Kinsley and Greensburg. I can't tell you if we played Havlin. After Lewis, we played Havlin, but we surely did. that wouldn't be so far away. And of course, that was a big entertainment. Parents want to see their kids perform, you know, and so. But not many people drove their car because you didn't have the gas.
Lewis, you know, rather very busy like Saturday night and things like that. Is Centerview still enough of a town? Or?
Well, no, not really. I can remember once in a while meeting Lewis or Kinsley, and everybody is in town. This is Saturday evening, and they're sitting on the front fender of the car, visiting with the neighbors, you know, and getting groceries. And you could get your hair cut till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, I guess, you know. That's just the way it was. No, Centerview wasn't in on that.
About how many people were in your graduating class?
At Lewis?
Well, no, at Centerview, before you left here. How long did you go here?
Well, like I say, there was four of us that were to be seniors. Okay. That went to Lewis, and there was already 16. That's the biggest class I'd ever been in.
And that's class of 48?
Class of 48 at Lewis. There was 20 of us graduating. And that was the biggest school class I was ever in until that fall when I went to Pratt JUCO. Of course, when you get to college, it's a whole different ballgame. But that's what happened, that some of you just run out of kids.
So during, so you would have just been starting high school at the end of the war.
Well, first fall was 44. It wasn't quite, it was still going in 44.
Yeah. But you weren't probably dating or anything like that yet.
No. No. Grandpa told me, he said, I can't let you take the car at night like that, because if you have any kind of a wreck, they'd take our farm. Which is true.
When did you start driving though for the farm?
Well, in 1936, in the good old Dust Bowl days, this half section, and Grandpa was trying to get enough wheat to plant wheat that fall. And he put me on in the seat of that Caterpillar tractor. Okay, it's got a straight exhaust, Ballard, and the combine's right behind me with a straight pipe, and it's Ballard. And it took me a while to get used to all that racket so close. And the only ground we cut was the low ground. I don't know if he got enough wheat to plant that pole. I don't remember that. I just know that was why we were doing that. So I started in the harvest of 36. Then later, of course, every piece of ground had a three-wire barbed wire fence around it, because you run the milk cows. And the fence was, you know, practically a half mile long here. And in the spring, he put me in the seat of that Model T Ford truck, and they had posts and wire and the steeples and all that good stuff to repair the fence, because during the winter, you know, thistles was blowing through it and tear steeples out. And anyway, to fix up, so that way he didn't have to drive and fix fence. So he put me in driving the old Model T truck and going with him, you know, to build fence. But that was the main thing I drove. And that was not out on the public road. That was in the field.
So during the war, did your life didn't probably change too much?
Not really.
Did your grandfather use hired men?
Oh, yes, for harvest.
And were they still available during the war?
There was a young man came from most generally Arkansas, and there was two young men. They weren't related, but they worked for Grandpa 2 or 3 years. Must have started ahead of the war. Anyway, this one that we liked, his name was Bill Burke, and he evidently got drafted, and he was in the Pacific. I don't remember where it happened. He wrote to folks. As near as we could figure out, he'd been machine gunned, because he knew about this full feeding hogs, you know, because we butchered. The neighbors would get together and spend the whole day butchering and, you know, getting meat. And
you had a smokehouse and...
Well, that was... Finally, the Lewis Co-op put in a locker at Lewis. Boy, that was... Oh, that was so wonderful. But anyway, this Bill Burke wrote to folks, and he said, I sure wish I had some of those innards out of those hogs. And we never heard from him again. So we just figured that, the folks did, that he'd been machine gunned. And those Arkansas kids, another thing that I couldn't hardly believe, they were barefoot. And they carried a pair of shoes with them. And where they grew up, the only time they wore shoes was to go to church. And they could walk through Mexican sandburrs, and they just rake them off, hardly miss a step. Boy, not me. I was never that delicate.
Did you notice any changes at school during the war? Did that go on pretty much the same?
Yeah,
teachers stayed the same?
Well, we had a teacher, too, that got drafted from Centerview. A math teacher, I remember, Mr. Dodge, he went to service. And another thing about my Aunt Joanne and her husband, Martin V. West, he... shipped out for overseas, and 2 days later, Joanne was in the hospital there on Fort Riley, and that's where their first daughter was born. And he never saw Nancy, their first daughter, until she was about 3.5 years old. When I was in the Air Force, he got a hold of me. One time I was home, and he said, whatever you do when you get discharged, keep your GI insurance. See, when he come back, he'd come in on ship to Seattle. And, of course, it was, I suppose, bedlam. I don't know. And he said, anything they said, shoved in front of me, I signed. And he signed his GI insurance. And he regretted that, but it was too late to do anything about it. So he said, be sure and keep your GI insurance. It's the cheapest insurance that you'll ever have.
The health insurance or life?
Yeah.
Life.
Yep.
Well, do you remember the end of the war? VE Day or VJ Day or anything that went on there? Or when people came home?
I might back up a minute before we get to that. In the wheat harvest of 1944, the Caterpillar tractor and the whole combine, the old Caterpillar tractor was pretty tired. And it went down before we got done. And a neighbor down south, a good friend, Parson Reed, came, Grandpa called him, and they decided that he was on his last leg pretty well. We'll have to be quite a bit of repairing, but didn't have time to do it because I was trying to finish the wheat harvest. And so Carson had 2D John Deere's, had a 28 or 32, and he told Grandpa, he said, of course, now our whole combine was on steel, you have to remember, and that pulls harder than rubber tires. And Carson said, come get that 32D. It'll pull that combine, and Grandpa didn't think it would. But his back against the door, you know, and he was trying to finish up the wheat harvest. So Grandpa was still debating, and Carson drove in with the with this 32D and hooked on, and it did. It pulled, maybe not as good as a Caterpillar, but it pulled it. And so Grandpa went to the ration board. I tried to find it in his diary. I thought he went to the OPA office, Office of Price Administration, but he went to the ration board and made application to buy a tractor. And they had to approve his application. I mean, it wasn't, he didn't go in and 5 minutes later it was approved. I don't know how long it was. And the board met, and then they decided that he was entitled to a new tractor. And it said in the diary that he went to Wyrick's and wanted to buy a D John Deere. This is the fall of 1944. And in that day and age, Bill Fravel sold Santa Dew Minneapolis tractors. And Foxes, George Fox, sold Case. And I thought Grandpa applied to each one of those, but according to diary, I was mistaken. And when you signed up at a dealer to buy a tractor, if you turned it down when it got here, then your name went to the back of the list. I do know that. And so first part of September, Wyatt's called one evening. I got home from school and said, "Lawrence, your D is here." In those days, you know, you didn't haul it on a trailer. Tractors were moved on the railroad, and they parked the flat car, and you had, I don't know how much time, I suppose you had a day, I don't know about that, but you had to get that tractor off of that flat car, or they started charging you, I think they called it demurrage. No. So when they got there, the dealer got it off so that Santa Fe could hook onto that flat car and get it going. And we went up to see the new tractor, and they had it jacked up on the back end, and both wheels laying flat on the ground, and they had run the inside of the wheel full of cement. But wait. We didn't have iron weight in those days. This is before they decided to use iron weight. So they used cement to weight the rear wheels of tractors. That's the way they did it. And they were just finished trialing. And Wyrick's John Deere was like in Kinsley was the Santa Fe Railroad and Main Street here. Wyrick's building was right here, just north of where the Kings of Bank is now. And I'd never had an opportunity to run a new tractor. And being 14 years old, I'm going to drive that tractor home. You didn't haul them. You drove them 16 miles. And so the next day or two, went up there. The only thing the tractor didn't have, it just so happened that that particular D. John Deere, and they had sold other 1944 D's, and I think John J. Riso's dad was one of them. Up until then, it had all been hand cranked. This particular D, and I have it restored out here, has an electric starter. Some of the other 44 D's had lights and a generator and battery, but didn't have the electric start. And that electric start on that tractor has really never given any problems. It's always worked. And so, of course, the parallel was paved in those days. And I came south to Kinsley and down the parallel so I could come through Center View and show everybody, you know, our new tractor. Because that's the first new tractor I ever had a chance to run. I'd run a lot of different tractors, but that was the first new one.
Now, would you have bought that on time, or would you have had the money? Would you have bought it on time,
or
would you have had the money?
No, well, if he didn't have the money, he went to the bank and borrowed money. No, there wasn't any, no John Deere credit or anything like that in those days.
But the bank would have loaned money for something.
Oh, yes. So I don't know whether, you know, he had to borrow some money at the bank or whether he had the money. I don't know that. But anyway, in those days, when you drove a vehicle away, the dealer had the money.
Tell us then about the end of the
world.
What you remember about?
You know, I remember his pictures, and Grandpa was a reader, and he always subscribed to Life magazine, and the pictures of the happy people. I remember some of those pictures. That's the main thing I remember. Of course, you know, this is for TV and all this bit. So now that if somebody hiccups in Lower Segovia, we know it in 3 seconds or less, you know. So I don't know whether communication is too much or not.
Do you remember how the community reacted to the soldiers returning, or how the community reacted to there was a casualty?
Well,
any of
that? Centerview was a small school, but there was at least 2 and maybe 3 young men that went to service in the Second World War that never came back. And I can't remember I do remember one of them was in Elmore that they raised watermelons over east here, about south of Truesdale, or south of Fellsburg in there someplace. But I know, of course, everybody that had somebody in service, they had some kind of emblem in the window, you know, and you just hoped and prayed that government man wouldn't come knocking on your door.
Was there any mention at school if a graduate or somebody who graduated was lost or?
Surely was, because a close community, like, you know, every community. And everybody was wanting to win the war. I'm sure it was that sort of thing.
Then after the war, you graduated in 48.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you already talked a little bit about, you know, why you signed up for the Air Force. What year was that?
Well, the Korean thing started in June of 1950. And that spring, my grandparents that raised me were married in Kansas City in 1911. And that one picture there showed Grandpa had some relation that owned a cabin in San Francisco Bay. And he contacted Grandpa and said, you can use that cabin for your honeymoon. And so they were there a week. So in 1950 in the spring, Grandpa pulled me aside one day and he said, Jeff, you're not married. And if I have wheat crop, I'm going to buy a new car. And I want you to drive Grandma and me to the West Coast. Grandma had a nephew in Seattle. And like I say, Grandpa was a reader, and there was different things along that he wanted to see. And then we came down the coast. Grandma loved flowers. And she had read how beautiful the flowers at the Washington State Capitol and the Oregon State Capitol and California State Capitol were on the ground, and she wanted to see those. And so had a good wheat crop, and he bought a new Ford car, and we left here on the 22nd of July, and we were gone 3 weeks in 2 days. And we went to Denver, Cheyenne, and then over the Bighorn. We went the northern route over the Bighorn Mountain. And I can't think of the name of that guy that Grandpa had always read that was buried at Earth on that Bighorn Mountain. And him and I walked up to the grave. He wanted to see it. Then the next thing that like blew me away was Bonneville Dam. And I'd never seen, the only water I ever saw when I was growing up here was in the tank for the cattle to drink. Well, when I played in the water, my feet would pull my head out of the water, so I was all right. Man, oh man, we got that Bonneville Dam, and the gentleman was taking us through, and he took us down by the turbines, down underneath. And they're spinning, and water's coming through. Before you get in there, you can hear the roar of the water as it goes through the turbine and comes up out there in the lake. And a whole new experience for me. I'd never seen anything like that. And this gentleman told us, he said, now you might be the last civilians to go through here. Because he said, we're expecting a call anytime from Washington, D.C., because of sabotage, to not take anybody down here anymore. But we got to go through it. And then we went to Seattle, and we visited Grandma's nephew there, and then we went out on the mountain that here a few years ago blew up and had a family picnic. And then we're ready to, but we'll go down, we're going to take the highway, the scenic route. It's against the ocean all the way down to Frisco, San Francisco. And we leave Grandma's nephew and family, and that morning, as far as I know, we're headed for California. And after we get away from the family, Grandpa said, no, we're not going to Oregon today. He said, I've read about it, and I want to do it while we're here. I want to ferry across Puget Sound. So we go around over, and as we're coming down to where the Second World War ships were tied up, I can't think of the name of that big ship, Yorktown. The USS Yorktown is the one we're facing, which later in the Korean thing, my little brother Keith is on for 3 years. He helps take it out of mothballs, and then he helps put it back, and then he finished up on the USS Raleigh. Anyway, we go past the Yorktown there, and we get over here to where the ferry is, and the ferry across, it's pretty good size, and the people are up on top, and the vehicles are underneath. Okay. We're out a ways from land, and the captain comes on, the captain of the boat, and says, right here, water's 100 feet deep. And I immediately think, I don't believe my feet keep my head out of water here. I'd be in trouble. And about that time, Grandma decided that she'd left something in the car that she wanted. So I go down to get it, and the car right behind us was a new 50 Pontiac, four-door. And these people were traveling with a cat, a family cat. Now, the cat could not see water, but you're not kidding him. And his eyes, he was sitting up on the back of the front seat. And his eyes were huge, and the claws were dug in. If I'd opened the door, he'd have just... He was so scared. So I got to see the USS Yorktown before Keith got on it. And then we go to Oregon and see the Capitol grounds. And then California's next. And when we get to the California state line, you have to open up trunk, and they have to inspect for certain things that you don't be able to carry into California. And I couldn't get the trunk open. There's a little trip there, and it had come off, and I wasn't too sure they wasn't going to, because we were not going into California until they got that trunk open. And we worked and worked and worked, and finally got it open. So that was a, after we got in Frisco and starting home, we came across the Golden Gate Bridge. So I got to go across it one time. And I just heard a couple of days ago, part of it fell. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that use that to get to work were in trouble, unhappy. Because I don't know whether they had another way around or whether it was going to take forever. But anyway, I remember the sign saying when we got out on it, if you have a flat tire or the car quits or anything, it was so many dollars, you don't do anything to your vehicle. You wait till a wrecker comes and gets you. And then we came on east, came to Colorado. Oh, another thing about that particular trip, 1950, going up in the Dust Bowl, we get back to eastern Colorado, and I had been on motorcycle into eastern, through Colorado to Denver and Pueblo and Colorado Springs, gypsy tours. That's a motorcycle gathering. In 47, 8, and 9, and ahead of this trip. And in 47, 8, and 9, when you went through eastern Colorado and western Kansas, everything was burnt up. It looked like winter. Okay, this 1950 car trip, we leave Pueblo, and everything's less green. And didn't think too much about it. We get out in eastern Colorado, it's still lush and green. And I begin to check the map to see if I am on a different road or there's something wrong here. And we get into western Kansas, it stays lush and green. And we get home, the mud holes are all full and everything. And while we were gone those 3 weeks and 2 days, it had rained over 11 inches of rain here. You know, it just...
Couldn't have been farming anyway.
Well, my mom and stepdad and their four kids moved into this house while we were gone. My stepdad was going to keep the farming done. And he farmed one day.
So what made you sign up or draft it or what?
Oh, well, that's plain simple. I wish I had that. Let's see, where is that? Well, Devon Stade and I, we had talked about it. We knew what we were going to do. If, you know, and like I say, this is not knocking any other branch of service, but he wanted to join the Navy, and I wanted to join the Air Force. And first thing we know, we get the little postcard in the mail, and we're both 1A. So we get together, and it goes on a little while, and we get another postcard in the mail, 1A. And he puts a date on that one, so when we go to have to report for a physical. And Devon had a car, and in that period of time, the recruiter's offices were in the post office building in Dodge City for this area. So Devon and I decided it's time for us to go talk to the recruiter and see what we can find out. And we go to the post office in Dodge City, and we go right to the Navy because he already knows for sure that's what he wants. And we start telling the recruiter our sob story, or whatever you call it. We're about to be drafted. And he said, well, he said, one of you is in really good luck. Because he said, I had a young man from Buckland that's supposed to leave tonight. This is on a Saturday. They're supposed to leave this evening, to go take his physical, and he showed up with appendicitis. So he said, one of you can sign up right now and leave this evening. So there wasn't any question. Devon signed up and went out and went into the Air Force recruiter and told him my sob story. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. I can guarantee that I'll have you gone next Saturday night if you sign up right now. So I signed up, and we came home, and Devon told his grandmother was still alive, living in Centerview, Mrs. Turner, and told his folks and his grandmother goodbye, and I took him back to Dodge City and made sure he got on the Santa Fe Chief, and away he went. And so a week later, they took me to Dodge City, and I got on the Santa Fe Chief, and we went to Kansas City, and of course, they put us up in the Hotel Phillips, which is a nice motel, or hotel. And this is ahead, a little bit ahead of TV. No physicals on Sunday. I don't know whether I told you about it or not. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I get so bored that I think, I'm going to go out and walk on this, see some of the town. And so I went out and started walking on the sidewalk, and I don't think I get 3 or 4 blocks from the hotel, and I go around a corner. Now, this was a good life lesson for me. I go around that corner, and I meet Hooks McLean, who was Bob and Bill McLean's dad. He was in Kansas City selling cattle. And why that was a good life lesson for me was it taught me that no matter where you are, you probably better mind your manners just a little bit, because, and you may not even see that other person, but the word's going to get back to the folks if you're doing something you shouldn't. Probably. So probably better just fly right.
How'd your grandparents feel about you?
Well, I don't recall them, because Grandpa, lived out in Dodge City in the First World War. I kind of think that he maybe regretted not being in service. They didn't seem to have, they weren't overjoyed about it, but didn't have any control. That's the way it's going to be, and that's the way it's going to be.
And you think, having grown up during World War II, that made you more inclined to want to go into service,
because in the back of my mind, the main thing I always wanted to do was farm.
So you wanted to go out and then come back and farm?
Yeah. I remember, I don't know what year it was, it was during the Second World War. Lloyd L. Doty, he grew up here in Centerview, a little older than me. Oh, I don't remember the other two boys' names. Anyway, there were 3 of them. And I think they were seniors. But they joined the service at Christmas time, the year they were seniors, and went to service. Lloyd Dale was in the Navy, and he said, maybe they were all in Navy. I'm not sure about that. But I can remember everybody telling them goodbye there at school, they were on the way.
Now, I know somebody that I know there are parts of Edwards County that, B-29s went over, did you see that when you were...
When we were out here, we didn't have that shop, and the old granary is bad shape right now, but that was the only place we had to get anything in, so we were working on machinery or anything. It wouldn't go in there anyway. Outside. And in the Second World War, it was all prop jobs, airplanes, and you can hear them. And There was B-17s, there was B-24s, there were B-25s. B-25s and 26s are two engine. Dodd City had 26s. I don't remember exactly where 25s were, but there was airplanes in the air practically every minute of the day and night. And on my 13th birthday, we had come from the harvest field and got out just east of the house, and this airplane was coming over from the west. And I happened to have a flashlight or something, and I pointed out and turned it on, you know. And now this was my birthday, and they winked back, if you call it with a light. But they were just, Ralph Baird told me, he flew 23 missions over Germany out of England. And he told me one time that he took his final training at Liberal. He flew 24s. That was a box tail, four engine, big. When he came to Lewis, he could fly a single engine, twin engine, four engine. That's a big deal. And he flew all. I thought in my own mind that he flew 25 missions, but I found out later he flew 23. But he never got injured. And it just blows me away to think that anybody could be with that many bombs and grenades and bullets and not get injured. Very lucky.
Question I haven't asked here. I know in France they had the blackout stuff because
it's supposed
to be the air base.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to do blackout things here? Where you could cover the windows or anything?
No. I don't recall
we
did that.
Nobody's mentioned that before, but I know in France, Jerry said that.
So the air base right north of Pratt there. And I'm not sure what planes they had anymore. I've kind of forgotten. But I can remember we'd go to Pratt. See, in those days, for us to go to Pratt, we most generally went to Centerview and north of Fellsburg and Truesdale and through Byers. And then they built a separate road for us to go by the base. Went to Pratt for repairs sometimes and things like that.
Right.
16 months.
16 months, okay. And then, when did you start dating your wife?
As I got home.
As soon as you got home.
She was a senior. And I was back in the Air Force. And after our engagement was announced, of course, the word around Lewis was, won't last a year. And I'm very thankful that was not true. I don't know. Some of that was because of my dad. I don't know. I'm just very thankful that it didn't pan out that way. One thing my grandparents talked, because they had gone through this, see, because my mom was 2 weeks after she was out of graduating from Lewis High School, her and her boyfriend went off and got married. So in 1929, I'm just sure that my grandparents were not overjoyed. They would not talk about it. Not to me. And so they were split the afternoon before I was born. So I've been told. I was there, but I don't remember. But I've lived a charmed life because of my grandparents. They took me in and listened to a smart mouth teenager and all this bitch, And I'm so fortunate. Because of it, in those days, as far as I know, the only jobs for a female was a waitress or a secretary, probably. I think that might have been part of the reason that my mom went to Springfield. She, grandma had a sister that lived right across from Burge Hospital and became a registered nurse. Because that was an honored thing, as far as I could figure out. That if you're a registered nurse, you know, you deserve respect, is the way it looked to me.
During the Korean War, what did you do? We might as well just keep going.
I was in the Atomic Energy Commission, which was a big deal. And see, when I was in basic, we were about, it was 8 weeks of Air Force basic at Lackland Air Force Base at that time. I think we were probably in the sixth week. They had a day of career counseling. And we went over to career counseling, and there was a questionnaire, you know, what you thought you might, what job you would like while you're in the Air Force, is the way I call it. So I thought, well, airplane and engine mechanic, because I've always liked mechanics, that's what I want. So I'm signed up to go to Sarasota, Florida for A&E training, airplane and engine mechanics. When it comes time to, after you graduate from basic, then they put us in barracks, and that's some of the people that's in this barracks are just waiting to ship out to go to tech school. You keep everything in your duffel bag, because you only have 30 minutes when the 6x6 truck comes by to pick you up. They're only going to wait on you 30 minutes. And if they drive away and you're not there, you're going to go to something else. So I'm sitting there waiting. It comes time for me to ship out and go to tech school. A runner comes to the orderly room. Everything comes through the orderly room. When they say jump, you jump. Okay, and this runner says you're to report to the orderly room. So I go to the orderly room, and the sergeant pulls out a sheet of paper, and it's all names, and there's my name, and there's a red line drawn to it. He asked me my name, and I told him, and he said, well, you're not going to Sarasota, Florida. You just go back to barracks and go to sleep. Tomorrow morning at 0800, you will report the billing number, and I don't remember the number. And so the next morning at 0800, there's 40 of them. When I get in there, you know, we're coming in. You're in the service. You're a few minutes ahead. You're not a few minutes behind. Get in there, there's 40 of us. Oh, God, the rooms. I got in there about 15 minutes ahead of time, and the ones of us that's in there, the rooms just flying like crazy, you know. We're going to Egypt, or we're going to all places around the world, you know. At 0800, there's a corporal walks in. Of course, he's the head logo. He just well been a two sergeant. Of course, when he walks in, because he's in Class A uniform, it's quiet immediately. And he said, there was a lieutenant general from Sandy Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, here, and looked over all your papers. And he said, that's where you're going to be going. He said, I don't know a thing about Sandy Base. He said, I guess you will find out. And he leaves. And so when it comes time for us to go to Sandy Base.
Did you know anything about Sandy Base?
Oh, heck, I'd never heard of it.
And nobody else had in there?
I don't think so. Yeah. And so There's the Lackland Air Force Base, and there's Kelly Air Force Base. Kelly Air Force Base is where the planes are. And all night long when we're in basic, you hear them revving up the engines. And, of course, it's mainly prop jobs. You know, it's a little bit ahead of jets. There was a few jets, but the main Air Force that yet was a lot of props. And when they're working on them all night long, you know, revving them up and letting them off. But it didn't keep you awake because you was tired after marching and everything else all day. And so we get on and put us on a, you have to put your mind back that many years, 70 years, whatever. And as we get on, as we get load on, it's an old DC-3, old tired DC-3. I suppose these three young men that were the crew, now they're not servicemen. They're individuals. And I suppose they own this plane, I'm guessing. And they have a contract to haul airmen to their technical list, the way I took it. And as we get on, there's one guy standing there, and he hands each one of us a three-pack of Chesterfield cigarettes. And I never really cared for cigarettes. I'm not bragging. I've smoked a few, but I never really liked the taste of them. And, but there's only two of us that don't smoke cigarettes, and we don't want to be the oddballs. So when we get to sit down and get the seatbelt fastened, I light up like an idiot. And and we take off. Now, from San Antonio to Albuquerque, if you look at the map, if you fly straight across, like we did, you go across some big potholes in southern New Mexico. Okay, I didn't know this ahead of time. And I smoked this cigarette, put it out, and go to sleep. Of course, before I went to sleep, I unfastened the seatbelt. Because they turned the light off, you know. Well, being asleep, I didn't see the light come on to fasten the seatbelt. And when I awake, what wakes me up, I've hit the top of the airplane. They're dropping 500 feet at a time, you know, and going over these potholes. And always liked Bob Hope. I always thought he was the greatest thing on radio that ever happened for me. And I'd heard him say one time, after the Second World War, that he had flew so many hours during the Second World War that he had learned how to say, "Please pass the cup," in seven different languages. And just as quick as I get my seatbelt fastened, it's right here. You know, it just keeps gaining a little bit all the time, and I'm swallowing fast as I can. And I've got the cup ready. And we touched down at Kirkland Air Force Base, which was right against Sandy Base on the south side of Albuquerque. And in fact, I think Kirkland Air Force Base is where the civilian planes land. I'm not sure. Anyway, as quick as we touched down, and it's right here. And I'm swallowing fast as I can. But as soon as we touch down, I'm okay. So then they get us off the airplane, and it's dress right dress. You know, that's standard procedure. And because there's just a fence between the two at that day and age. And they march us over to our new barracks. And we're marching to brand new barracks. Nobody's ever lived in them before. And it's cement floors. And as we, of course it tickles me anymore, but it didn't then. As we're marching out of some of the barracks, it's already got people in, and we had all branches of service at the Sandy Base. And there was a lot of brass. And you go out around, go out a door outside, you might meet a general. You didn't know who you was going to meet. And as we're marching to to our barracks. There's some kind souls in these other barracks that started there. You're going to be sorry. welcoming committee, I suppose. I talked to Keith Newsom about it. He was in the Navy in Vietnam. Yeah, he said, that's pretty normal to welcome you, make you feel good. But it was a good command. And one of the first things it told you, you will write mom and dad, or whoever raised you, and you were telling them to, you arrive safely and, you know, all this bit. But you will not disclose any secrets off this base.
Did they censor your mail, Dale, or did they trust you?
I don't think they went through the mail, but I never did write anything in there because they told us that if you disclose any secrets here, we find out about it, it's really going to be bad for you.
And you spent your whole time there?
Yes. Sure did. I'll tell you, I'm very glad to have spent my... The folks got me out early because Grandpa had been climbing up in the granary down there and fell and broke some ribs and he wasn't able to farm. And so they wanted me to take over the farm. But it, I'm glad that I served as long as I did, you know, did something because I think this country is the best in the world. I'm just thankful that I was born and raised in the United States of America. I may not agree with all politics, but I love America. Good to me.
Mm-hmm.
On this new tractor that he bought in 1944, in that day and age, 1944, Rexall Drugstore was here, and then my Uncle Bill Nichols Pool Hall, and then a gamble store. And the only thing the tractor didn't have on it, was batteries. Of course, there wasn't anything. It was 12-volt batteries in those days. You had to hook up 2 6-volt batteries in series. And it just so happened the gamble had 2 batteries, and they got her going. But he wrote a check, as I recall, for the tractor, the wires, for $1,870. I think that was the amount that cost him. Mm-hmm.